Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's another interesting day. There's got a call from somebody telling me that folks of California finally woke up and going to recall Governor Newsom. We'll see. You know, there's a thing online. 1 million people are going to storm Area 51. That's just if they can find it. Now, to get to Area 51, you first have to find Rachel, Nevada, population 9 when I went there. Back in the early 90s, I took a busload of people to Rachel. And then the next morning, we went out to Area 51. Now, that used to be the closest place you could get was the road that ran into the Groom Lake area, which is the original name of Area 51. It's called Area 51 because of a map reference on a military map, just like S4. Same thing. And the big black mailbox was the first thing you saw. It was purchased by a group and taken on a world tour. I mean, people pay good money to look at a black mailbox. No accounting for taste. In 1997, I went to Roswell, where the black mailbox is making a personal appearance. That was the 50th anniversary of the crash. And they had all the vendors set up in convention center, and it was packed. I've had 75 copies of my first book. And if you got one of those, it's now worth, so I'm told, a couple of thousand dollars. It's a purple cover. And I had a box and I dropped it. People came to help me pick them up and saw what it was, and I sold all 75 copies for $19.95 each, sitting on the ground in the parking lot. Never had anything to take inside. That was quite an interesting event. But if you, by chance, could find Area 51, and you want to storm it, well, you got two things you have to deal with. Fences, and you don't see those until you get further up the road. Outer security, which are called the camo guys. They wear camouflage uniforms, and they hide in the bushes. And then the internal security is called yellow fruit. Now, a member of that group used to call my radio show every night and talk about some of the strange things that went on there. And I asked him, now he's the one that told me about yellow fruit. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. He said, nope, that's the name of the internal security. So I talked to a friend of mine that worked at the Pentagon, and I said, have you ever heard the name yellow fruit? He got very quiet. He said, where'd you hear that? And I explained it to him, and he said, yeah, that's true. That is the internal security force. And they have orders that if the base is going to be overrun, they're authorized to use deadly force. Now, if a million people come storming across the desert, number one, you're not going to get a million people out there. You'd be doing good if you get one out of 10. But even 100,000. And you go storming across the desert, about 25% will wind up with broken ankles. The desert is not smooth. Also, the heat in 975 snakes per square mile. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Now, last night we were talking about oddities involving the moon. We talked about Project Crystal Knight. Now, according to Bill Cooper, that was the name given to the exchange of ambassadors between the human race and the extraterrestrial biological entities. 12 people were selected in 1965 and sent for 13 years to what was reported to be the planet where the EBEs originated. Now, this exchange program was said to have run to 1978. And of the 12 that went, 8 came back. 2 died. 2 wanted to stay. And the remaining 8 came back to Earth. Now, the very idea we have a treaty with space aliens brings to rise a number of questions. Could some of them be living among us? Now, that's not an unbelievable concept. It's not more unbelievable than the fact they exist in the first place. And I've always thought my first mother-in-law was a space alien. She acted like it. Now consider, if you will, that we've all met people we consider strange. Especially in the big city, there have been stories about truly unbelievable people who've lived very strange lives. Could they be aliens? How about hybrids? Certainly the very idea of contact between man and some sort of mimicking entity are not rare. In fact, such contacts number in the millions throughout history. And I might also point out, at the risk of causing coronary arrest among those who are rabid believers in our world's religions, that the very concept of most religions are based on the concept that man has been in contact with a higher being. Whether you call it God or an angel or Harry the Hairy Ape, the concept still remains a human meant something extremely weird by earthly standards and interacted with it. Even early man was well aware of the possibility that he or she could come in contact with those who weren't exactly human. In the Bible, Hebrews chapter 13, verse 2, the Bible is very clear. Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware. Well, at this point, we have to ask the question, what is an angel? Now, most angels in the Bible are described as looking like ordinary men. Down to the angels have wings was an artistic concept to make it clear there was something beyond the ordinary. And I would submit that at its basic definition that an angel is a representative of a higher power. Be that higher power a god or more powerful entity than a mere human. And it should be noted there are literally thousands of stories of interaction between humankind and, for lack of a better term, inhumankind. And setting aside the strangeness for a moment, let's ask some practical questions. Where do all the odd creatures live that are wandering our planet? Now, there are places on this planet that are rarely visited by educated man. In the U.S., there are a few places that are not at least regularly passed through. But a place that would certainly fit the bill as a home to these mysterious entities would be the moon. Well, science has long taught us there cannot be any life on the moon as it's an airless rock floating in space. Now, where they got that idea is anyone's guess, but in the face of that, you have to ask why we might think there might be life on the moon. Well, the concept there might be some type of life on the moon began when Marconi, the inventor of the radio, reported his experiments in transmitting radio signals to the moon resulted in his receiving answering signals. He sent a message and something answered. Shortly after that, in the 20s and 30s, astronomers in America, Britain, and France reported seeing glowing, moving, and even blinking lights on the surface of the moon. Then in the 1950s, John O'Neill, an expert in aerial phenomena and a Pulitzer Prize-winning astronomer, reported seeing a lighted bridge on the moon he believed was built by mysterious intelligence. Numerous other astronomers began to survey that same area of the moon where O'Neill had seen the 12-mile-long bridge and forced to admit that he had, in fact, seen such an oddity on the surface of our deserted moon. That bridge was later dismantled, which would seem to be an indicator that there was intelligence involved. Should also be noted during the 50s and even into the 60s, there were many UFOs that were tracked by both civilian astronomers as well as government tracking stations traveling from the Earth to the moon. In fact, I found a NASA technical report that lists activity on the moon from the mid-1500s to 1968. Seems our deserted moon has been a pretty busy way stop over the years. And certainly a moon base would be the perfect place to hide a fleet of UFOs. Well, from the latter part of the 50s to the 60s, a number of astronomers recorded moving, flashing, and stationary lights on the surface of the moon. Should be noted, much of this activity seemed to be concentrated inside the craters dotting the surface of our satellite. And so it was that with a massive expenditure of time and resources, the United States landed a man on the moon in 1969. And much like Columbus landing in the New World, it was time to plant our flag as a sign of conquest and break out the champagne. Or maybe not. There is evidence we were not the first to set foot on the moon. There is a report that when Buzz Aldrin opened the door of the lunar lander, he found himself staring at a sentient creature that seemed as surprised to see him as he was to see it. It should be noted that there were a number of communications that were hard to understand between the astronauts on the moon and Houston. Perhaps this can be explained by something said by NASA Director Kraft when he commented on the fact that there was both the public as well as a private radio channel between the moon and mission control. This private radio channel was certainly in support of the requirement if NASA discovered anything that would tend to support the existence of other life forms was to remain classified as part of its charter. Very few people bothered to read its charter, but that is part of its charter. It's noted that at the moment of landing, there was a mysterious 2-minute interruption between the men on the moon and mission control. Perhaps this sentient creature that Aldrin came face to face with was the topic of conversation. I've also heard mention of this strange communication from a number of ham radio operators who had VHF equipment allowing them to listen directly to the astronaut communications, and they heard the discussion of the creature Aldrin is alleged to have seen. Even ham radio operators in Russia reported to have heard these censored communications, and when they published the information in Moscow that there were creatures on the moon when we got there. Now, in spite of the efforts by NASA Mission Control to censor the communications from Apollo 11, apparently there was a slip-up in regard to communications from Apollo 15 when astronaut James Irwin, the lunar module pilot, talked about dome structures that are partially filled up. Breaches either flowed into these structures before they were built, or the domes are younger than the floor. The area is oval or elliptical. Other communications talked about flashes of light, buildings, roads, tracks, and huge blocks. At one point, he made the comment, "That's the most organized structure I've ever seen." Of course, when space program officials were asked about the comments, they were told the comments by Irwin were metaphors for geological formations. Clearly, somebody in government thinks the man on the street's an imbecile. While James Irwin was touring domes on the surface of the moon, Al Warden, the command module pilot for Apollo 15, was having his own interactions with someone or something on the moon. According to Warden, at 11:15, there was an unusual fading of communication with the mission control. He said he heard a breathing sound and a long whistle. And then there was a sentence constantly repeated on one note, varying from small to a shrill tone and from lightly stressed sounds to raucous exclamations. Well, the MEMS tape recorder captured the message, and when communications were reestablished, he transmitted it to NASA. Since we're going to note that his transmissions to Mission Control was also heard on French public television, though that should have been impossible. The message recorded and transmitted to Mission Control consisted of 8 words in an unknown language. Those 8 words were Mara, Rabbi, Alalardi, Dini, Endeavor, Essa, Cons, Alam. It's never been transmitted, or if it has, the meaning has never been released by NASA. No, it's never been translated instead of transmitted. There's a comment that's long been attributed to Neil Armstrong. He's reported to have said, "We were ordered to move away by aliens on the moon." According to reports, speaking unofficially, Armstrong has said a number of times, "We were warned away." I can't go into detail except to say their ships are far superior to ours, both in size and technology. They were great and they were threatening. Well, on the 25th day of January 1994, the Clementine mission was launched as a joint project between the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization, Star Wars, and NASA. The stated mission was to explore the areas of the moon and take photographs. Well, when scientists reviewed the data from Clementine, they discovered, contrary to basic beliefs about the moon, ice existed inside some of the moon's craters. That finding was further confirmed in early 1998 by NASA's Lunar Prospector. Now, I'm not a scientist by any means, but I do know if there is ice, then there is liquid, probably water, on the moon. And in fact, there have been a number of sightings of water vapor coming from the surface of the moon. Now, we've been assured that could not be the case, but facts say otherwise. In addition to this came a statement from Dr. John Brandenburg, deputy manager of the Clementine mission. In an interview, he stated that the Clementine mission was a photo reconnaissance mission, basically to check out if someone was building bases on the moon that we didn't know about. Were they expanding them? He also said, "Of all the pictures I've seen from the moon that show possible structures, the most impressive is a picture of miles-wide rectilinear structure. It looks unmistakably artificial, and it shouldn't be there." As somebody in the space defense community, I look at any such structure on the moon with great concern because it isn't ours. There's no way we could have built such a thing. It means there's somebody else up there. It's also interesting to note, though it's been kept very quiet, NASA released a two-ton Centaur kinetic weapon that impacted on the moon on October 9, 2009. Now, for those not familiar with this type of weapon, a kinetic bombardment is the act of attacking a planetary surface with an inert projectile where the destructive force comes from the kinetic energy of the projectile impacting at a high velocity. In other words, it's not an explosive device. It is a high-speed impact. And that in and of itself carries a lot of energy. It was said this was done for scientific purposes, but there's a large number of people believe this was done to destroy a number of alien structures that had been built on the surface of the moon. It should also be noted some of the very ancient craters on the moon's surface resemble nuclear bomb craters more than they do craters left by asteroids. It would seem perhaps we're not the first ones to bomb the surface of the moon. It's also claimed by former NASA employee Clark McClellan that mining operations were observed by the Apollo 15 astronaut crew. Of course, nothing was said to the general public. If someone is mining the moon, then clearly they've established some control over our satellite and feel secure in conducting our operations. Of course, there are two primary questions. What's being mined and who's mining it? Certainly the activity that's been spotted on the moon since the mid-1500s could be and probably are other life forms, the very existence of which is kept as a very closely held secret. But there's another possibility that needs to be seriously discussed. Now, it's common knowledge that any technology demonstrated by our governments 1, possibly 2 years obsolete. Therefore, certainly possible our space program is also obsolete, which leads to some very interesting questions. Now, earlier we talked about length about the possibility that the U.S. government had demonstrated a great deal of concern about these lights in the sky. In fact, in 1952, after a fleet of UFOs buzzed at the Capitol, President Truman was alleged to have given the CIA the order to contact the entities flying these mysterious craft. And, of course, there's the reports that President Eisenhower even entered into a treaty with them. So if these UFOs were and are looked at as a threat, then logically our military would begin to look at a way to prepare for interaction with these entities. Therefore, we might need to look at what, if anything, our military did that might relate to readiness to deal with UFOs. Well, it may come as a great surprise, but in March of 1959, Project Horizon was undertaken by our U.S. military to develop and build a permanent lunar outpost. According to a letter signed by Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, who in 58 was Director of Army Research and Development, he was Chief of Research and Development for the General Staff in 1959, and he sent to the Chief of Ordnance of the Department of the Army that there was a requirement for a manned military outpost on the moon. Now, this outpost was required to develop and protect potential United States interests on the moon, develop techniques for moon-based surveillance of the Earth and the space and communication relaying and operations on the moon, to serve as a base for exploration of the moon, for further exploration into space, and for military operations on the moon if required, and to support scientific investigations on the moon. Now, it's interesting to note that in his letter, Lieutenant General Trudeau made it clear there are no known technical barriers to establishing a manned outpost on the moon. Now, if this is true, then perhaps there is currently a manned outpost monitoring both the Earth as well as outer space. It's most certainly true that the description of the structure discussed in Project Horizon materials and carefully outlined in the military's proposal for the building of the manned lunar outpost seems to mirror in many respects some of the structures caught in some of the NASA lunar photos. Certainly the story put forward by Alternative 3 1978 would seem to indicate that both the then Soviet Union as well as the U.S. had manned installations established on the moon as well as an alleged colony said to be located on the planet Mars. Now, we'll discuss Alternative 3 and its ties to some of the worldwide disappearances of those with a technical background later on, but for now, we have to be satisfied with the assertion that the plot outlined in this unusual book supports, in many respects, the idea that there is life on the moon. Now, for those not familiar with Alternative 3, it was part of a British science series, and in retrospect, it was allegedly an April Fool's joke, but it wasn't broadcast on April Fool's. And according to the story laid out in Alternative 3, there was a meeting held among the various governments when it became clear that we were facing a number of problems. One of them was global warming. Alternative 1, blow holes in the ozone layer so that the heat would dissipate. And to do that, we would use nuclear bombs. Alternative 2, build underground installations suitable for holding large numbers of people. Alternative 3, colonize the moon and Mars as a starting point. When I was in England, I saw a video purported to have been filmed in 1963 that showed us landing a manned craft on Mars successfully. And if in fact we first put people on Mars in 1963, then they've had, 50 years or more in order to develop their colony. Now, frankly, the establishment of the validity that there's life on the moon would only take one unexplainable sighting of activity on the surface of the moon. However, there are hundreds of sightings that I found in a NASA technical document that covered 400 years. Now, it doesn't take much in the way of an investigative ability to be able to look at lights and movement in an area that's not supposed to have light. So, in spite of all NASA's denials, there's verifiable proof that there is someone on the moon. The question is, are these moon people or aliens? Now, the document that I found is dated July of 68. It's called A Chronological Catalog of Reported Lunar Events. And it's NASA Technical Document R-277. Now, in the introduction, it specifies this is a catalog of lunar events or temporary changes on the moon that's been compiled based on literature covering more than 400 years. In the majority of these cases, the original reference has been consulted. Secondary sources, such as the new edition of Husserl and Lancaster's Bibliograph General Astronomy, were also used. Each entry includes a brief description and date of the observation and the name of the observers, where these are known, and the reference number. Now, what you got in this document are the confirmed reports. They eliminated all doubtful reports. Now, there are some other reports that were not included in the catalog. J.H. Schroeder saw a kind of ferment on the floor of Plato, which is a crater, which closely resembled a kind of twilight. In 1856 and 1860, J. Smith noted weak glows in the crater Basunagulp, but he doubted these were more than sunlight on the walls reflected from the floor. Why would it reflect off rock? In 1878, John Hams and friends in Iowa reported seeing a lunar volcano. On a dead planet. In 1899, it was noted the inner parts of Copernicus glowed in weak phosphorescent light, though not directly lit by the sun. 1909, the non-illuminated part of the moon glowed red. 1964, where the observations record progressively changes by a succession of observers, apparent without adequate checks on subjectiveness, that called a few reports into question that otherwise would have been looked at with great interest. The bottom line to all this, no matter how you look at it, if there's one light seen on the moon, that calls into question the long-held belief the moon is a lifeless rock. But we've had a number of astronomers, actually see 12-mile-long bridges crossing craters. They weren't high. They weren't writing science fiction. They were reporting their observations, which were confirmed by other astronomers. Was that reported? Of course not. Because it's just like the scientist who said rocks can't fall from the sky because there are no rocks in the sky. Well, that does not take into account meteors. Now, no matter how you look at it, it winds up becoming a question that is of great import to the whole world. Are there aliens on the moon? Now, there's a great deal of evidence that German scientists made contact with alien species as early as the 1920s. And were building flying discs and conducting space missions by 1942. There is, I've read a number of reports about a test pilot who orbited the Earth in a Nazi-built craft in late 42, early 43. He survived the war. Now, numerous UFO researchers have made a connection between alien beings and such German secret societies as the Thule, the Vril, and the Black Sun. And in his seminar, UFO Secrets of the Third Reich, Vladimir Tuzinski tells of an alien tutor race that secretly began cooperating with certain German scientists in the late 1920s, introduced them to advanced philosophical, cultural, and technological concepts. With the help from these extraterrestrial intelligences, the Nazis mastered anti-gravity flight, established space stations, accomplished time travel, and developed warp-speed spacecraft so they might build moon bases. Anti-gravity research began in Germany in the 1920s with the first hybrid anti-gravity circular craft, the RFZ-1, constructed by the Secret Royal Society. These societies did exist. They're historical facts. In 1942-43, a series of anti-gravity machines culminated in the 350-foot-long, cigar-shaped Andromeda space station that was constructed in an old Zeppelin hangar near Berlin by the research and development arm of the SS. Now, Terzinski is not alone in making such claims regarding extraterrestrials and Nazi cooperation. Though some researchers scoff at him as pure fantasy, others are convinced there was a Nazi alien connection and another massive cover-up by the international shadow governments. Skeptics wonder how Germany could have lost the war if they amassed such superior alien technology. Well, the problem is they couldn't get them into production fast enough. We do know shortly before the Third Reich collapsed in 45, Wernher von Braun, Hermann Oberth, and about 80 other top scientists were smuggled out of Nazi Germany by the Allies, who also captured various documents, files, plans, photographs, and designs. However, one specific file containing discoid-shaped aircraft and 130 crack Nazi designers of specialized aircraft vanished. Then there's the Bell, which is supposedly based on advanced concepts. It disappeared, and all the scientists that worked on it were assassinated by the SS. UFO researcher Hammy von Rome has stated that the mysterious disappearance of that vital file, together with over 100 technologists, must be added to the list of oddities that took place shortly before and after the fall of the Third Reich. Among these oddities, various researchers cite the unexplained disappearance of several German freight U-boats, each capable of transporting up to 850 metric tons. They had some huge submarines. The disappearance from Tempelhof Air Base of several long-distance planes with flight plans to Spain and South America. Disappearance of tens of millions of marks in hard currency, gold bullion, and precious stones from the Reich Bank. And the fact that UFOs were and continue to be sighted in great numbers over areas of South America in which many Nazis and other secret societies are known to be hidden. The fascination of German science with rockets began in 23 with Hermann Oberth's book by Rocket Interplanetary Space. Numerous other books by other experimenters advanced the cause of spacecraft development in Germany in the mid-20s. 1927, a Society for Space Travel was organized with Wernher von Braun and Willy Ley among its members. That society produced the world's first rocket-powered automobile, the Opel Rock 1, with Fritz von Opel in 1928. Further experiments were made with railway cars, rocket sleds, crewed vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, and some successful launches from the rocket airfield near Berlin. When Hitler seized power in Germany in 1933, the Nazi Party took over all rocket and aircraft development, and all astronautical societies were nationalized. In 1938, Hitler's aide Martin Bormann ordered the careful mapping of all mountain passes, caves, bridges, and highways, and began selecting sites for underground factories, munition dumps, and food caches. Giant underground workshops and launching pads known as U-plants were established in which top German scientists will be assigned the task of creating secret weapons. Slave labor force of 250,000 was required to complete work on such fortresses. Networks of tunnels and assembly plants were fashioned in Austria, Bavaria, and northern Italy. Allied intelligence learned to work on the Project Fireball, translated as Fireball, at the Luftwaffe Experimental Center near Oberheim and Emmergau in Bavaria to create an aerial device that would confuse Erod radar and interrupt electromagnetic currents. Efforts were accelerated to perfect the craft in 1944, but work appears to have shifted to development of the Kugelblitz, a circular aircraft quite unlike any previous flying object in terrestrial aviation history. In May of 1945, after the Nazi surrender, British agents searching the files of some underground factories in the Black Forest located a number of documents describing important new experiments relating to a new turbine engine capable of developing extraordinary power. Rumors abound that Canadian intelligence took plans for an advanced circular aircraft from Peenemünde, site of the main Nazi rocket experimental complex in 37 to 45, and presented him as a challenge to the scientists at the de Havilland Aircraft Company. According to other rumors, the engineers de Havilland actually made the flying saucer fly, briefly, but they never mastered the propulsion techniques required to keep the craft in the air very long at one time. So we were left with the question, did the Nazi scientists manage to keep their flying saucer in the air for a long period of time, long enough to establish bases on the moon? And let's not forget, when Operation High Jump went to Antarctica, according to reports from Admiral Byrd, they came in contact with aircraft that outperformed the best that we had. So there's a lot of questions that have never been answered. And the unfortunate thing is they never will be answered at this point in time. Well, there is evidence that the government's covering up proof of an ancient civilization and what's thrived on the planet Mars for fear the shock of such a discovery would destroy their own civilization. Now, frankly, I think that's silly. I think we would easily adjust to the concept that once upon a time there was a more advanced civilization. Brian O'Leary, author of Mars 1999 and Exploring In and Outer Space, worked with Carl Sagan at Cornell University, was an Apollo astronaut. Now, he's supportive of the Mars Pathfinder probes, but disappointed by what he regards as NASA's lack of vision, especially the agency's failure to investigate adequately the Cydonia region and its mile-wide structure that very much resembles a human face. Richard Hoagland, author of The Monuments of Mars, has studied and gathered scientific data on several provocative photos of the surface of Mars taken by NASA's Viking probe in 1976. Now, these photos show certain formations that appear unusual compared with the rest of the geologic features on the surface of Mars. He contends these formations are artificial, not unlike the Egyptian pyramids or Sphinx. In fact, he goes so far as to say that some of these features may have been constructed by some alien race thousands or even millions of years ago. He also claims the same possibility exists for Europa, the moon of Jupiter, as seen in Voyager mission photos. But NASA is not going to thoroughly investigate any of these because their charter requires that they not reveal any information that would tend to support the concept that there's an alien race, or that evidence has been found of an alien race. Now, Hoagland was a consultant to NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center from 75 to 80. During the historic Apollo missions to the moon, he served as science advisor to CBS News. First time he saw the mysterious Sphinx-like face in the Martian landscape known as Cydonia was the summer of 76 when NASA's Viking had taken 100,000 pictures of Mars. When a group of reporters and scientists were shown the initial image of the face, they were told the spacecraft had taken another frame a few hours later in which the whole image didn't appear. It was all a trick of the light. But when the project scientists at NASA made a joke of the preposterous thought it could really be an artificial structure, everybody laughed with him. At least according to Hoagland, because after all, everybody knew NASA's highest objective was to find evidence we're not alone in the universe. Well, that's not true. Yes, subsequent investigations have yielded what he believes to be evidence not only of the mysterious face, but of several five-sided and four-sided pyramids. In his firm and educated opinion, no natural force could have fashioned such regularly repeated geometric structures. It's as if an unknown ancient alien culture had left a message for those who would discover the objects in an undetermined future. Maybe the message in Sidonia is that a code had been laid out for those intelligent enough to figure it out, astute enough to determine the mathematics and the geometry that can open up new gateways to the universe. Well, in April of 1998, when Mars Global Surveyor sent back photographs of the face of Mars that were clearly expected to debunk any theories that an ancient Martian or other extraterrestrial civilization had carved a mysterious feature. After 22 years of waiting for clearer photographs that would confirm the handiwork of intelligent life on Mars, the new picture showed only eroded landscape and a pile of rocks. While other researchers fulminated about NASA having erased the face, Hoagland stated he was really far more interested in the ruins of what appeared to be as what's been called the city of Sedona. And now he could only wonder if NASA had missed obtaining better pictures of the city on purpose. He told USA Today in May of 1998, this is an ancient ruined architecture we're seeing. He went on to accuse NASA of having obtained photographs that could confirm his theory, but were refusing to release them because that would so shock humankind that civilization might collapse. Tom Van Flandern, former head of Celestial Mechanics at U.S. Naval Observatory, who currently runs a Washington, D.C. group called Meta Research, stated that because the Martian region photographed by NASA has so many odd patterns and shapes, he had placed the odds at 1 to 1 against all of them having occurred naturally. According to Van Flandern, the fact that the desert surrounding the face of Mars is flat and featureless is of great significance in contrast to this sudden 400-meter object rising at a regular height all around with perfectly straight sides. 90-degree angles are common. The bottom is symmetric. He claims even in the new images, the eye sockets and forehead are well-defined and match up well with the original photo of the face. Well, continuing with his analysis, Van Flandern told Art Bell on Coast to Coast radio program before seeing the new image sent back by the Mars Global Surveyor, we knew that a fractal content implied a natural origin, or regularity, angularity, and symmetry implied artificiality. I see almost no fractality with the exception of the nose bridge, the feature least protected from wind erosion. I do see smooth lines and curves, right angles and corners, and lots of symmetry, especially detailed symmetry in the headdress enclosure. Well, in 1984, Richard Hoagland organized the independent Mars investigation. He had been a fierce advocate of the position that NASA has been withholding knowledge concerning structures and artifacts discovered on Mars and the moon that would yield proof of extraterrestrial civilization. Hoagland has come to believe there are two space programs out in existence, one to appease the taxpayers and another conducted by a top secret group with a hidden agenda and much more sophisticated equipment than the public mission. Well, there have been a lot of talk about the story I did on UFO researchers' mysterious deaths. And I've had some requests, if I'll go over the name of those researchers again. Whether it's a fatal visit from the Men in Black or a secret government agency, there is evidence that UFO investigators are dying. Now, with all the paranoia about secret military cover-ups or the UFO mystery and whispered fears about the men in black, some researchers have claimed that a number of UFO witnesses and investigators actually have met their demise at the hands of mysterious assailants. In 1971, the author, researcher Otto Binder, wrote an article for Saga magazine called A Special UFO Report. He titled it Liquidation of the UFO Investigators. He claimed to have researched the deaths of 137 flying saucer researchers, writers, scientists, and witnesses who died in the previous 10 years to that date, many under the most mysterious circumstances. UFO researcher G. Cope Shelhorn been tabulating the deaths of ufologists from unusual cancers, heart attacks, questionable suicides, and all manner of strange happenings since 1997. Admittedly, some of the researchers on the list were getting up in years or were by the testimony of family and friends in ill health or depressed or suicidal. Still, you have to say where there's smoke, there may be some fire. So to comply with the request I received, I'll give you a few names. Morris K. Jessup, 1959. He was an astronomer and an archaeologist. Well-known author of such influential works as The Case for the UFO and The Expanding Case for the UFO. He supposedly committed suicide in Dade County Park, Florida in 1959. Now, those who researched his death have found a few troublesome facts. Contrary to Florida law, there was no autopsy. Police Sergeant Oben Klein, who was on the scene shortly after the body was discovered, said everything about the setup seemed far too professional. Supposedly, Jessup ran a hose from his exhaust up through the window. But that still left some questions. He died at rush hour with more than the usual amount of cars passing by, and nobody noticed anything out of the ordinary. And Jessup had recently been visited by Carlos Allende, the mysterious letter writer of the famous Philadelphia experiment investigation, only 3 days before his death. According to his wife, Jessup had been receiving strange phone calls at all hours of the day and night. He was actively investigating the Philadelphia experiment at the time of his death. Frank Edwards. One of the first books I ever read about UFOs was Frank Edwards' UFO Serious Business. Died of an alleged heart attack June 24, 1967, on the 20th anniversary of Kenneth Arnold's sightings. The World UFO Conference was being held in New York City at the Commodore Hotel at the time. Chaired by UFO publisher and author Gray Barker. Barker stated he'd received two letters and a telephone call saying that Frank Edwards would not be alive by the time the conference ended. And he wasn't. Dr. James McDonald, senior physicist, Institute for Atmospheric Physics, professor in the Department of Meteorology at the University of Arizona, reportedly died of a gunshot wound to the head. He'd worked hard in the 60s to convince Congress to hold serious, substantial subcommittee meetings to explore UFO activity. Also, no autopsy. Ivan T. Sanderson, well-known naturalist, zoologist, UFO investigator, and author of All Things Strange, died of a rapidly spreading cancer. Philip K. Dick, 1982. Occult science fiction author, he wrote Blade Runner and Minority Report, was also said to be a silent contactee of some higher intelligence for many years. He died of a stroke under rather mysterious circumstances. He'd been writing a nonfiction book about his experiences with alien contact. After his death, the manuscript couldn't be found. It had vanished. Captain Don Elkin, 1984. Professor of physics, mechanical engineering, as well as an Eastern Airlines pilot. Captain Elkin had been investigating UFOs since 1948. Deep into the study of the raw material, alleged in extraterrestrial communications channeled by Carla Ruckert at the time of his alleged suicide. No autopsy. Dr. Alan J. Hynek, 1986. The death of Hynek, a famous astronomer and consultant to Project Blue Book, due to a brain tumor, seemed suspicious to many at the time. Supposedly in the hospital for prostate surgery, his death seemed even stranger when one considers the high number of UFO investigators who died of brain tumors or cancer. Those who knew him well recall that he seemed troubled over some recently acquired data shortly before he entered the hospital for what was to be a minor procedure, relatively speaking. May Brussels, 1988. A gutsy, no-hold-barred investigative radio host who was acutely interested in UFOs as well as the dangers of the New World Order. Another victim of a fast-acting cancer. Deke Slayton, 1993, an astronaut, purportedly ready to talk about his UFO experiences. Another fast-acting cancer. Ron Rummel, former Air Force intelligence agent and publisher of Alien Digest, shot himself in the mouth with a pistol. August 6, 1993. No autopsy. Anne Livingston, 1994. She was an accountant, but she was also a MUFON investigator. December 29, 1992, she claimed to have been accosted by five MIB who she described as being almost faceless and carrying long flashlight-like black objects. Died of a fast-acting form of ovarian cancer. Now remember, I think it was Ian Fleming who said, once is happenstance, twice is coincidence, three times is enemy action. And this list alone, you got over half a dozen fast-acting cancers and brain tumors. Carla Turner, author of Masquerade of Angels, Taken and Into the France, suspected the breast cancer that preceded her death was due to alien retaliation for a statement she made in print. Another fast-acting cancer. Ron Johnson, 1994. He was MUFON UFO Network Deputy Director of Investigations, only 43 and in excellent health. He was attending a Society of Scientific Exploration meeting in Austin, Texas, on June 9, 1994. Died quickly and amid strange circumstances. He was watching a slide presentation when the lights came back up. He was slumped over in his chair, his face purple, blood oozing from his nose. A soda can from which he'd been sipping was sitting in the chair next to him. Died. No autopsy. Well, that's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow when we'll be talking about more UFO-related incidents. Until then, Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.